They were indicating there in the passage that in the film, they probably showed it twice. Remember what chapter it started with? Genesis chapter 1. Let's turn there this evening and look at a few verses as we start this out. Flight is an amazing thing. And when we look at this portion of Scripture, I want you to keep in mind that while this video was concentrating on a particular kind, flight is something that is across more than one area. Birds have flight. We also have mammals that have flight. What's a mammal that flies? A bat, okay? And we also find from archaeology that we had flights from dinosaur type of animals, and so there were flight is included in also in bugs, and we have your bees, we have your beetles and various things like this that have flight. And so when we're looking at Genesis chapter 1, verse 20, this verse says, "And God said, Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven." Now, I want you to remind me, what day was this that God created this type of creature? No, one more. Fifth day. That goes down to verse 23. So this is very interesting, because on the sixth day, then we had what type of creatures that were created? Land animals, okay, and also mankind. So let me ask you a question. When were the dinosaurs created? On the sixth day. When were the fowls created? On the fifth day. Now let me ask you this other question. Those of you who have had secular education, what day which was created first? I'm not asking what day. Which was created first, the dinosaur or the birds? The dinosaur, according to the creation, to the non-creationist person. Okay. So now we have a real conflict of ideas that's involved here, and this is something that we need to keep in mind as we study the Scriptures. And now let me ask you a question. When these folks who are who believe that Darwinists is probably the typical name that you would know them by, when they say that the dinosaur was first, were they there? They weren't there. Do they have written history concerning this? They don't have written history concerning this. Does the creationist, was he there? Okay, do we have written history? We have written history. So we're rolling up on this one right here, aren't we? We have written history that's given to us that, and by the way, this is what we would call an eyewitness history that was then given to Moses, who wrote it down and preserved it for us, right? And so we have one up on them on this. They weren't there, and they don't have written history. And not only that, but we have some interesting things that are involved in this. When we're talking about the difference between dinosaurs and they're saying that dinosaurs somehow modified in some way so that then they became birds that flew in the air. This is an interesting concept that we have, and we need to think this through. Do we have any typical designs that could probably be said as being living dinosaurs today? Probably you're going to find them more in Florida or maybe southern Alabama. And we would have crocodiles and alligators. They would be typical of that, of a type, the lizard type. You look at the dinosaurs, many of them look like lizard types as you see pictures that they would present them as being. Then there are others which, I can't say the name, Velociraptor. That's the typical name that's showing up in the comic pages and in many of the probably the Discovery Channel things anymore. That's the typical name. But that would be T-Rex would be similar to that, would be probably a part of that family. They're designed, it appears that now when I was a kid, the T-Rex was an upright animal that basically the head was up in the air and the tail dragged the ground. Now they bent them over and make them show as being a high-speed runner type of an animal, and so they've come up with different opinions as to how they were designed and how they operated, and of course when I was a kid and they were in my textbooks, that was the absolute truth. But now they've kind of changed things, and now they're saying that's the right answer. And so we see that in the process of all of this, that those who are the evolutionists are carrying on in their designs and their studies, you find that back in the 1930s, compared to the 1950s, compared to the 1980s, compared to the 1990s, 2000 era, we're finding that everything that was said to be true is changing along the way. One of the things I noticed when I was at the University of Idaho was that they kept changing when things began, and the date kept being pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. And so, and they say this is all science, but they weren't there. Think about this, they weren't there. And now when we're looking at all of this, not only were they not there, but we're also finding that their dating methods that they used, they kept upgrading them, but now they're running into some real troubles because a lot of their dating methods that they claim that they use, for example, if you go to the local rock shop and you find a piece of rock and they say, this is millions of years old, how do you know? What's a common way of dating that's often mentioned? Carbon 14. Now, if they say this rock is millions of years old, carbon 14 dating only goes back 60,000 years. Now, let me ask you a question. If they say this rock is 2 million years old, and you say, how do you know? Well, carbon 14 dating. You say, oh, you're having a fire sale on this piece of stone. You're selling this, it says marked on here, $200. It's only worth probably $2 the way you're telling me, because you can't date something that's millions of years old when carbon 14 only can happen 60,000 years back. And so obviously you're pulling some strings here, and this must be a $2 rock that you happen to find out in the backyard. Now, when we're thinking of all this, we have to keep in mind that the information that they call science, and it's in most of the books that's in the high schools and junior high schools and elementary schools, most of the information that they have in a lot of this stuff is so far outdated, they know it's wrong, but they're still publishing. In fact, it's been wrong for 40 years or more on a lot of it, that they know, and yet they're still publishing it with up-to-date books. So this is interesting. Now, what we're doing here is we're looking at this dinosaur, this Velociraptor that he's talked about, and this dinosaur somehow, as it was running along the way, somehow started growing feathers. And you may notice in some of the pictures they have feathers coming off the four legs and forearms that are there. You realize they don't have any hard... Somebody wants in. They don't have any hard, concrete evidence concerning this animal having feathers. They don't. This is projected ideas coming out of the imagination of their hearts. And so they're saying, well, somehow this dinosaur started growing feathers, and as it ran along, it started flapping and gained some muscles, and all of a sudden, zoom, he went up in the air. And this is how we have birds. The problem is that that's not how we have birds. Birds came first or second? First. Birds came first. And we have written history to verify this. Not only that, but one of the things that is, as we look at the dinosaurs, they have special bones that qualify them for not flying, but rather for running. One of the things, how many of you have eaten a chicken? Any of you have taken the chicken apart a little bit on your plate? You know, you have a half a chicken, and you have the wing up front, and then you have, on the other end, you have the back legs. Who likes the thigh? Oh, you like the thigh. Okay. Now, one of the things that you're being cheated on is that the leg bone, drumstick, is a lot longer than the thigh. And the thigh basically doesn't really leave the chicken at all. The chicken, when he's running down the path, running across the chicken yard, you'll find that it's the knee that shows up as the start of the leg. And then the other parts is the wrist and the fingers. That's what is on the chicken. Now the thigh is basically stays inside of the chicken, and it has all these muscles and it's strong. But one of the things on the chicken is that the thigh bone stays pretty much stationary. It moves some, but it bends at the knee. That's how the running takes place. Now, the Velociraptor, this dinosaur, it doesn't do that. The thigh bone is outside of the leg, is outside of the body of the animal, and is a major part of the running. The bird doesn't need that. In fact, the thigh bone is there inside of the bird and helps protect the breathing system from collapsing. You notice that it showed the air coming in and kind of like the lungs and all these sacs along there, and it says it goes into the bone, the air does, to help provide for this animal. And what happens is that if the thigh bone didn't stay pretty much stationary with minor movement, that then the strength of the other wing bone, of wings muscles and stuff that were making the bird fly, would crush the chest and cause the breathing to stop. And if they've tested out that if the thigh bone isn't able to do the work, that then the bird loses 20% of its breathing capability, and therefore becomes so weak that even walking across the barnyard becomes a real feat, and they tend to get too tired and fall over. So the design is different between that which would be any of the dinosaurs and that which is of a bird. The design is totally different in many, many different ways, such that you can't get these changes by minor incremental changes that would go from generation to generation. Another thing has to do with the bird and its heart. The bird has an extra large heart, and it is able to provide blood to the rest of the body. I believe it said it 20 times of what we have for us. Flight requires a lot of energy, and they have to get the blood from one spot to the other to provide energy for the cells to be able to do this heavy work of flying and to be able to stay in the air. Flying is extremely work intensive. Even for the birds that you see soaring up there, which catch the winds, and some of them, like the eagle, you see them soaring and circling around, maybe the vultures and some of these different kinds of birds, the seagulls, they have the ability to catch all these winds and stay up and soar to a degree, but it takes a lot of energy to fly. And in order to get that heart enough air to be able to circulate all this extra blood to all of the rest of the animal, they have to breathe. They have to breathe a lot different than you breathe. You breathe in through your nose. Some of you are mouth hangers, but that's okay. Breathe in through the nose and go down into your lungs, and the air goes into all these little tiny air sacs and provide oxygen and whatever's necessary to the blood, which then is carried to the heart and carried to the body. But that is inefficient. Birds cannot fly, have not the energy nor the ability to fly with sufficient air, except that they have a whole different design in lungs. Now, the dinosaur has lungs that are similar to ours, from what they've been able to tell, and which from living dinosaurs would be crocodiles and alligators and such various lizards that we have. Their ability to breathe is very much like ours. But you go to the fowl, and you'll find that what they do is that they have a continuous flow of air that goes through their lung area, in one side and out the other, and keeps on flowing so that it doesn't have to go in, sit there a while, and go back out. It just keeps on flowing. It gives them a much higher rate of transfer of air, so that it goes into the blood. The heart then pumps it to the rest of the body, keeps it to the wing, and so that they might be able to flap and continue on in their work. So we find that the design is totally different in many, many different ways. You'll find that that it talked about the wishbone that's in the bird. That's your collarbone. That's similar to what you would have. The collarbone is built, designed different in the birds than it is in the mammals, such as you and I. Part of the strength of that collarbone is to prevent the chest from collapsing under the stress of the wing muscles. Now, everybody likes a turkey. And in our day and age, which kind of meat is advertised as being the best for you in a turkey? The white meat. The white meat comes from the breast area, doesn't it? Where all the breast muscles are, which then part of the breast muscles pull the wings down, and part of the breast muscles go in behind and help, like a pulley, pull them back up. And so these muscles are intensely working and extremely strong. If it wasn't for the design, the special design of the breast, which you know that the back of the bird is like this, and then the breast muscle comes down like that, there's a special design in that made so that it doesn't crush the bird with the exercise of the muscle to provide for flight. There has to be a lot of strength in that. And so these muscles are working back and forth, pulling the wings up and pulling them back down again. And so all of this is special design. You don't have that. Other animals don't have that design because the strength that's required with these muscles would literally crush the chest of the bird if it wasn't specially designed just for what it is. So we have the ability of these things to be there. Remember the pictures that they showed of the that it showed with regard to the feathers? The feathers were they're made in an unusual way. The feather itself, of course, you have the quill that goes out, and then all the side pieces, and then they have even cross-hatching from those side pieces off the feather. And you saw the hooks that were on there that they would catch each other and help hold the feather together. It was interesting in reading one area that talked about the feather is so tight that you cannot blow smoke through a feather. That's the tightness that is built into this feather. Now, the feather itself, everything past the point where it attaches to the body, is all cells that have died. You think about this, how that the feather, as it is made, it is some kind of a protein molecule that grows and starts forming the feather, and once it gets out there a little ways, that protein dies, and then all of this design is made of something that, well, I guess they think your hair is not being a living organism either. It starts here, and proteins build it out and gets longer and longer and longer, but the feather is far more intricate than anything that a hair would be. And they're saying that somehow the lizard has scales that would form, somehow start forming feathers. Well, that's a long ways to go. You look at the intricacy of that feather, and you say this happens a little at a time, and Darwin says everything that happens a little at a time must be efficient or it's not preserved. and has to be efficient and usable, otherwise it won't be preserved. One of the things that Darwin, statements that I've read concerning Darwin is that birds themselves, a feather, the concept of a feather in birds, made him sick, physically ill, because he couldn't explain the intricacy that it was there and how it would come about by natural selection that would be involved. So these are very interesting concepts that are related. We have these animals which were made on the fifth day, and to say they weren't designed. How could you have all of these systems? You have the feather, you have the heart, you have the lungs, you have the muscles, you have the structure that the bird is made so that it won't collapse and destroy itself when it's flying and carrying itself on. Of course, that doesn't have anything to do with the eyes. The eyes, you look at a bird's eye, and a lot of times that the bird's eye seems to be, well, is it that much different than yours? A lot of the birds, you know, they're outside, and then they have the pupil, and it's in the middle, and it looks like they look out. But we talked about the blind spot last week in Sunday school. You have a blind spot in your eye. You look, put an XO here and a zero here, and look at the one, and the zero over there will disappear if you hold it at the right distance, and it'll just flat disappear. You have a blind spot. But birds have a major blind spot that's probably, maybe 70% of the eye, but that which sees is able to see in such a manner where it can focus and see what's going on. Some of the birds are able to not only see in the daytime, but they're able to see at night, have night vision. We don't have night vision like the birds have. You know, it's what we would be, what almost goes to black and white for us as we're outside and you wait half hour, and then pretty soon you can kind of see things out here and there. And if there's enough starlight, maybe a little moonlight or something is out there, you can begin to see images of trees a little bit. But I defy you to recognize somebody's face with that kind of vision. You think of the owl. The owl can see, they can look from, they stand on a fence post from here and that back toward the end of the church, and in that distance, they'll see a mouse running across, and he just goes and gets it. And the ability of sight is amazing in birds, and the whole process of the way their eyes are made are different than ours. In how it works, and they're able to. He also knows that the birds have eyes on the side. The focus of the eye apparently is to the front, but they're also able to pick up side images. And you look at birds, great big flocks of birds as they're flying, and why don't they run into each other? There's 1,000 birds coming up, going like this through the skies, coming off the power lines and flying around. Why don't they run into each other all the time and whack each other and have two or three of them falling down to the ground? You don't see those things. They know the difference where it is. The bird's metabolism is different than the mammals. We have birds that start in Alaska. They fly all the way across the Pacific Ocean and winter in the Hawaiian Islands. Now you think about this for a minute. We think of some of the birds here, the Canadian geese. They come from Canada, they stop in the Allegheny River, and they eat and carry on, go down to the next river and eat and carry on. Finally, they make their way down to the far south as they would go. Now, think about this. They fly a while and they stop. They fly a while and they stop. But we're talking about 5,000 miles. 5,000 miles, small birds. They're able at the right time, as God would work it out, they're able at the right time to be able to get on, gather enough extra fat to fly from Alaska all the way down to Hawaii. And not only that, but when they arrive, they usually have between 15 and 20% extra energy. But mathematically, it looks, as you put it on paper, like they haven't got enough energy to make it all the way, based upon the calories that they burn. And they're finding out that these birds are able to get up in the air, and that because they fly in flocks, and you've seen the V formations that some of the different birds will have, the Canadian geese will use this method, they're able to rotate to the to the front and back to the back, and they're able to increase their ability of flight and distance considerably because of that, so that instead of running out of fuel before they get to Hawaii, they have enough to go all the way beyond, even in contrary winds. Contrary winds would slow them down and make extra work in order to get to where their destination is. How do they find Hawaii? That's not a very big place when you're coming from Alaska. If I blindfold you and say, I want you to walk from the front of the church, go back and touch the cross, the window that's back there, some of you would end up over there, some of you would end up over here. How do they get there? Because of design, God has put within them a navigation capability so that they are able to go from one place to the other and get there accurately. You can't be playing games when you're flying that far. I had a friend who went from Wisconsin to different ports in Michigan. And he had a compass in his boat. And in those days, we didn't have all the navigation from the satellites that's available, no TomToms for him. He was able to set his compass, and based upon the wind, he was able to go from Wisconsin to Michigan to the port city. And even if it was foggy somewhat going across the Lake Michigan, he was able to get from one side to the other because of a compass. God has built into birds magnetic compass capabilities so that they're able to go from one place to the other, and not only that, apparently correct for wind. Amazing. We can't do that without special instruments. We can't do that which is native within us. So these are things, as we're looking at birds and we're looking at design, people are saying, oh, this just happened incrementally at a time, a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, until finally we come to the place where we have birds, and it came from dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are built altogether different. In fact, now there's information coming out where even the evolutionist is realizing the bird can't come from the dinosaur. Even though they're still publishing it that way, they realize that if there was to be any similarity, they had to have had some common ancestor way far beyond either one of them. And just between you and me, they're guessing because they have no evidence. They're guessing because they don't want to believe that there is a God who designed. Even though the creations speak of the glory of God and the firmament shows forth his handiwork, they're saying, yeah, but if there's a God, I'm accountable. I'm accountable. One of the things that I'd like to bring it down to is that when we're talking, one of the things that in Genesis 7:14, I'd like to bring it down to this. The evolutionist likes to say, well, yeah, these things fly, but what about the bat? What about the bat? And obviously, you as creationists say, well, it has to be that the Bible's wrong because birds and bats aren't of the same species. And you're trying to make all this work together. And I'd like to show you in Genesis 7:14 that there's very much room when you look at the word fowl and you look at the word bird, that even the Bible makes a difference between them. And it says in Genesis 7:14, they and every beast after his kind, all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing upon the earth after his kind, and every fowl after his what? And every bird after of every sort. So there's some differences of comments that are related here, that the word term fowl is a broader use of the term than the word bird. And so if they're trying to lay details on you, you can take them to Genesis 7:14 and say, oh, well, that's what the Bible says, so what? You know? They try to split hairs on you. You can say, well, the Bible says that too, so what? There's room for the flying creatures. And if you want to be picky, here's a verse that helps you back things down just a little bit. So there's there's a difference there that's between them.